There's no boundary between the two. There's a continuum, a greater frequency of certain traits in human society as opposed to animal society.
Do you think so?
Certainly, I think
so. And you've read Levi Strauss.
Pardon?
And you've read Levi Strauss.
Sure, I've read Levi Strauss extensively, and I think that is one of the...
I think you meant, you said that Marx saw that the distinction between culture and nature was labor. And I believe it was Levi Strauss who said that it was not labor, but the rules of reciprocity.
Versus the laws of nature. But I have recent hot information from Levi Strauss with the correspondence.
Just so happens.
Right, right off, hot off the press. He now claims, and this occurred while I was at Rutgers, the correspondence going on between Levi Strauss and Robin Fox, that he's now of the opinion that somehow we have to put culture back into nature and see culture as a part of nature, that the difference between nature and culture that he emphasized in his work was only a momentary necessity to further an argument.
The
now,
point I'm making is that the distinction was not labor, the distinction was rule, the rule of instance, which was the human universal.
Or cooking in the mythology. By cooking, man distinguishes himself from the rest of creation, because no other animal cooks.
Okay, what is the difference between nature and culture? Where there is a boundary, and how do we know when we've crossed it? And whatever Levi Strauss may or may not think now is not really relevant, since as you well know, Levi Strauss is a pretty good representative as the one about the origin of the society, includes the whole of structuralism. Most people, especially people acquainted with Marx, if you realize that there is a boundary. This is, there's a boundary between the physical world and the organic world. There is a way of saying, okay, we can look at this.
Yeah, well, it's, as Levi Strauss says, it's a conceptual boundary. It's not out there in nature.
You mean chimpanzees have kinship systems?
They certainly do. And they've been extensively elaborated.
They have names?
They don't name them, but they interact with certain consistency in certain relations. And now the material from the social sciences, kinship studies, is now shedding light on research in sociobiology. Because anthropologists have dealt with kinship for so many years and have acquired quite a kit in which to analyze it, sociobiologists groping in the dark have now applied social, anthropological techniques to ethology. So there's a cross-fertilization. It isn't all in one way, where the biological enlightens the social at every turn and not the other way. Now they've extended these to look at the various genealogies and relationships. They now know that chimpanzees hunt and engage in exchange behavior and have certain kinship.
We know this, but I'm still trying to get my question answered. I'll ask it another way. What is the difference in logical typing between society and nature?
It's arbitrary, depending on the particular culture that's doing the separation. There's no universal line.
Do you think it's just like one-dimensional, it's just a long continuum?
It's a continuum with greater frequency.
And that's all it is? There's nothing distinctive about society that separates social systems from gregarious animals?
You can get a number of traits together and put a frame on them and label them distinctive. That's valid. That's part of our way of classifying the universe. That is what Levi Strauss
said. But you seem to be saying that there aren't any, or that it's completely arbitrary. It seems that
it's arbitrary, but not completely arbitrary.
But there is conventional, but. No formal assumption which can be empirically located. So, the boundary and empirical boundary is continuum.
Well, of course, we know there's a continuum that came out of evolution, but we need to know, in order to talk about it, of a boundary.
So, the choice of establishing a boundary where it's more suitable.
Okay, and it's a place where you can draw it, but I can't get an understanding of this question about boundaries in answer to my question. I guess that's what I mean.
Why don't you tell them why I think it's important?
Well, because I think it's critically important to know the difference between levels of complexity in the cosmos, because the social sciences are absolutely bedeviled by hundreds of years now of confusions of levels of complexity, of drawing analogies out of animal behavior and applying to society, about taking social notions and applying them to animals and back and forth in a sort of one-dimensional, thoroughly mixed up and contradictory fashion. I think today we've got ways of perceiving that is a problem, that we're talking about even there are different labels on it, you know, confusion of levels of complexity. Society is of a different order of complexity from a natural ecosystem. I think it's important to know that. And one can talk about also that there's a confusion of classical thinking. And that it is, unfortunately, it has a very powerful ideological content and structure involved in it, and that it serves the ideology of the society to make those confusions. And that's really the question that I'm asking you, is, in a sense, to what degree are you aware of the way in which Marx or Darwin served the dominant ideology of that of the 19th century, and in what way are you aware that some of the things that you're saying are still serving that same ideology? And I would pick on your use of socialist natural. I would pick on your use of a primitive society and your comparison with that of a communist utopia, which is not what Marx thought, and your use of the word man, and the implications of progress in your own, in the way that you're talking. That's what the question is about.
Hey, give me one at a time.
Would you like to make a speech in response to that speech?
I'd like to take them one at a time.
I was asked to make a speech.
No, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind about one thing, that Marx saw the communist society of the future as being loosely based on what he conceived primitive societies to be. This is expressed in the German ideology.
But he said, when he says, said in the Grundrisse specifically that that is a romantic dream that comes out of the bourgeois ideology.
No. He's talking about, when he talks about the romantic dream, he's talking about the Le Robinsonade, the political economist of the previous century, and their notion of natural man as an isolated individual. That's what he's referring to.
We're talking about different things.
Well, let me stress what he says in the German ideology. He talks about the communist society of the future and its unalienable nature, how man will hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, be a critical critic in the evening, yet not be any one of these. And clearly his model for this is primitive society, but primitive society as perceived by romantic literature.
Yeah.
Later, with the Ethnological Notebooks, he began to deal with the hard facts of primitive life, and it just served to affirm his belief, which Engels extended upon in The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State. He talks about the egalitarian nature of the primitive clan, and so on and so forth, extending things which Marx dealt with in a romantic way in his early writings, and now that they had the ethnographic wherewithal to deal with these in a more empirical way, Engels extends the argument in The Origin of the Family. And I think
it comes out of the ideology of progress.
Sure, the ideology of progress is in both Marx and Engels. So I agree with you there.
Yeah. Why do you refer to the German ideology that Marx wrote it? When you refer to specific passages, do you know which one wrote which particular passage? Because I never seen you study it, right?
No, that would be a very interesting study.
You know, sometimes you find a footnote that says this is in Marx's writing in the margin, so we know it's a statement by Marx. But it's written by both of them. And now you seem to be saying that Marx is as advanced in the natural sciences as Engels was. I don't see the evidence for this if we take the dialectics of nature and the anti-theory. Marx never writes that way. You have notions in Engels that feedback and counteractive adaptivity that Marx doesn't use.
Look, anti-Döring was written by Engels at a time when he was seeing Marx daily. He read the entire manuscript to Marx. Marx even contributed one chapter to it. At the same period of time, the dialectics of nature were being written. He was seeing Marx again almost every day. At this time, Marx was writing the mathematical manuscripts, which were going to be part of the dialectics of nature, but which unfortunately have never been published except in Russian. Marx had a tremendous influence, interest in natural sciences. He was the most well-read layman of his day in the natural sciences.
I know, but there is a difference between the obscuring.
Well, if I obscure it, it's because Marx obscures it. I'm not stating...
I don't think Marx obscures it.
Oh, I think, if you want to call it obscuring, I think he saw the link, an invariable link between the social and the natural sciences. This is expressed in the Paris Manuscript, it's expressed in Capital. It's a constant theme running throughout his writings. In the Holy Family, he specifically attacks critical theory for trying to separate social and cultural analysis from natural scientific understanding. And there's been a very interesting article, A Critique of Marcuse, by a fellow called Sedgwick, in which he does this at length. No,
what
Marx...
What about the theory of perception?
Pardon?
What about the difference in their theory of perception? Engels and Lenin on one side and Marx on the other.
The difference in perception between Engels and Marx is a matter of style.
I said the theory of perception, the theory of how we perceive.
I'm talking about the theory of reflections now. In Capital, Marx said, the external world is reflected in the human mind, and then he added, translated into forms of thought. And Lenin didn't pick up on the translated, he just kept this thing about reflections going all the way through. Engels said, okay, the human world is reflected by the human mind, but he didn't use the word translated. His style was different, but he said essentially the same thing, that there is the human brain which mediates between the external world and our thoughts, and it's the biology of the brain which governs this. Engels states this fully. I don't think you can attribute what Lenin did with reflections to Engels. I think there's a link, an irrefutable link, between Marx and Engels, although they were different personalities and they had different writing styles. I think their lifelong collaboration is indicative of a compatibility of thought that it puzzles me so many people want to disclaim.
Well, because there are very important contradictions in a whole tradition of dialectic materialism and historical.
I don't think so. And I don't think Marx thought so either. He was totally aware of Engels' later writings, and before Marx died, he put it in his will that Engels could take his writings, Marx's, and publish them in any way he saw fit.
But that's, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean a damn thing. Marx could be utterly naive about what
he... Well, if you believe that Marx has any integrity, he had Engels write the articles in the New York Tribune, and Marx's name was...
But seriously, look, we're getting into an old problem called the intentional fallacy, which is what Marx intended or what Engels intended. What we have is a text. We don't have what they intended. We don't even know what they intended.
Okay, I can find myself to the text.
No, you're not. You're imputing motives to Marx about what he thought about Engels. I'm saying that's not relevant.
No, I'm saying that now, but I can find myself to the text in the book.
You mean, and wait a minute now. I don't understand that response. Because
I'm responding to your question, so I impugn motives, okay? But when I put this analysis down, the chapter on Engels and evolutionary theory, where I look at the argument that's been put forth recently, trying to sever Marx and Engels, I counter it based on an analysis of their work. And although they are stylistically somewhat dissimilar, they were different personalities, there's a basic theoretical similarity. Engels, in Anti-During, in a journalistic way, expressed the fundamental tenets of what Marx was talking about in the material conception of history. And Marx knew what Engels was writing, and I can't go beyond that, other than knowing that Marx knew that this work was coming out, that it was a popularization, a journalistic account of Marx's writing. All I can say is Marx knew about it, and stop there. Yes. If you want to say there's a subversion going on, a revision, okay, fine. All I can tell you is that Marx knew about this work. I therefore assume that Marx condoned it. That's my stance.
But there's also the issue of the letters which Marx wrote, very critical of the intellectual products and endeavors of Engels, which Marx's friends destroyed.
That I don't know about. Yeah. I've never seen anything like that.
Just what Peter McKellen said, the Times literally something of the UP youth volume one of the collective works. There's a lot of correspondence which was destroyed because it didn't say very nice things about Engels.
The only time I've been through the correspondence I could ever detect a rift between Marx and Engels occurred when personal and financial matters came to the fore rather than theoretical matters. When Engels' mistress died and Marx was insensitive, they were very antagonistic to one another for several weeks, and that soon abated. I could find in the correspondence there's no real theoretical divergence between them.
Have you read the collected correspondence or the selected correspondence?
I've read every edition I could lay my hands on, the one from Moscow and the one edited by Donatello.
There are 12 volumes of letters in the collected ones. There's only one volume which has been translated into English.
I've confined myself to the English because I do not have the ability to read German.
You see, but the question goes beyond that, right? It's this question of the text, and who gives a damn whether Marx condoned what Engels
did? Yeah, okay, the text.
I mean, that's really not important. We have some very important differences and a kind of a sliding away from some really important notions that Marx had. This is the way that I'm...
No, I don't see it. I see it's a popular, kind of journalistic account of the profound analysis that Marx put forth. You could call it superficial and not doing...
No, I'm saying that it misses out in some very, very crucial notions. One is the one that you mentioned about the adding of the notion of the mediation of ourselves and perception, which Marx insists on and Engels forgets.
No, Engels does not forget. I cite that at length to show Engels talks about the human brain in the same way Marx talked about the human brain, that he implied that reflection was followed by translation, and it was Lenin who really caused the trend to go in the other direction. It was Lenin who altered what Marx was saying, not Engels at all. Because Marx, in Capital, when he talks about this translation and reflection, talks about the human brain, and the argument is picked up again biennials and the dialectics of nature. And although the terms differ somewhat, he's expressing the same opinion as Marx. He also goes on to talk about consciousness and its role in human history. Engels has been accused of being a mechanical materialist. He's not. He adheres to consciousness in a way very similar to the way Marx adheres to it. And I cite several passages in his writings to indicate this.
Paul, let me interrupt at this point. There's several people here who have a particular interest in what you would see yourself possibly teaching in a course like ours in communication studies. Could you just spend a few minutes describing your interest here in as much detail as you choose to?
Sure. I'm interested, and I guess it's an outgrowth of the Marx-Darwin work, in the history of social and anthropological thought with reference to theories of human nature. And this could be readily adapted to the history of communications thought, beginning in, say, the Enlightenment, coming up through the 19th century, looking at Marx, Darwin, and a number of related thinkers that I've mentioned, bringing it up into the 20th century, and perhaps, and I've discussed this with several people earlier today, assessing the whole McLuhan phenomenon from the point of view of intellectual history and sociology of knowledge. Looking at Ennis, McLuhan, the whole McLuhan phenomenon, things in McLuhan which are anticipated by other writers such as Marx and Durkheim, and a general assessment in this area. It would kind of be a selected highlights of communication theory, or a best of communications thought, until it could be filled out in other ways. It would be sort of a preliminary, provisional venture dealing with communications-related ideas in the works of thinkers in the social sciences and humanities and even the biological sciences. One of my areas of interest, which I try to apply a kind of Marx-Darwin approach, although I'm not yet ready to do this, is in the area of the evolution of symbolic behavior. I'm interested in art and the evolution of symbolic behavior. And this would include things such as primitive prehistoric art, ritual, and so on. Let's see, what else? I'm interested in what I guess you can call intercultural communication, theories of myth and cross-cultural studies in cognition and the like.
And how would you be presenting this material in a quote objective manner when you would lay it out and the students could discuss it, or would you be criticizing it?
Which now? The
in terms of the course or whatever.
Well, you're referring to the history of communications thought. I try and present it not so much at first in a critical way, but just trying to distill out what these people said that were relevant to communications and trying to deal with it as objectively as possible. What I see is relevant to communications in the writings of major thinkers. It would be a provisional formulation. At some future time, it could be critical. I know that a lot of people are critical of McLuhan, and I was a few years ago and have become less so of late, been more sympathetic to him. I would just try to present it, and the impact, the presuppositions, and so on, in a kind of broad way, as objectively as possible, without being specifically critical. I think the criticism to emerge from the presentation of the material, rather than be an inherent part of the way I present the material. If that's possible.
And what kind of text would you use?
Oh, I can't even get into that now. I'd have to look around and see. Original sources, when they're available, I'd have to see if there were, say, any works dealing with the history of language or something that may be relevant to people in communication. I really haven't had a chance to think about it or survey the literature. Certainly segments of Marx and Darwin, Darwin's expression of emotions in men and animals, which he gets into nonverbal communication. Things in Marx, maybe the Paris manuscript of the German ideology and so on. Excerpts from the work of Kropotkin, Tenney's, Bradley, people like that. I have not really given this thought yet.
Have you thought about pedagogical approach, how you deal with the classroom?
What did you say?
Yeah, of course. Well, what's your approach to pedagogy? I mean, what do you think of?
What's your teaching style?
Well, in past performances, I've taught a quite diverse student body, which included potential majors in anthropology, people from Newark who were barely literate, people in general liberal arts, and I felt my fundamental task was to inspire, to create an interest in the work at hand, and hopefully, and did succeed.
How do you do that? Could I ask for some specifics?
It's hard to put it in a pointed way. I try to inspire, and enthusiasm helps to inspire.
How do you inspire?
Through enthusiasm. I know that's not very specific, but it seems to have worked in the past, and I believe in what I'm doing, and I tend to convey that attitude in it, and this has been so in the past. I don't believe in force-feeding information. I believe in trying to sort of kindle an interest which can then be... feed is not the word. Then be receptive to more particulars in the area of pure information.
You couldn't say whether you preferred lecture format or seminars or depends on the class or...
It depends on the course. Some courses...
See, on the graduate level, how would you handle a class with 15 people in it?
I've been in a lot of graduate courses in my time, and this may be contradictory to the way you do things around here. Most of them have been seminars. Most of them have been awful. There's been very little guiding coming from the prof. Students have been expected to prepare, usually on short notice, things which they do not have a full grasp of. I believe in performing, putting some guidelines down, presenting my perspective, and feeling comfortable in doing this to such a point as I feel student participation will emanate, rather than go in and say, this is a seminar and we're going to have a perfect dialogue between all of us. I found in the past it doesn't work. The students want to get some insight into what the teacher is thinking, have some basis from which to present their own questions, their own ideas. So I believe in a graduate course it should be in seminar social arrangement, but should begin in a more formal way and then gradually loosen up at the discretion of the person who's guiding it, to go by feel, so to speak. Over the last several years, graduate students I've encountered kept saying, hell, why don't we have graduate courses where the prof says something instead of just throws out a few comments or makes us do all the work? And this attitude is so prevalent, yet in situations it has not been that way. The profs say, oh, the students wanted it this way when they came here. They didn't want guidelines imposed or us to lecture. They wanted a seminar. But, that was, at the time, the delusion of the profs in point. The students did want a little more, at the graduate level, formal presentation from the teacher.
I
would start that.
So you're returning to that?
Yeah, I don't go in for these sort of do-your-thing seminars.
Generate the excitement in the class, and then the students would hopefully take up.
Yeah, I want some sort of guideline, some way into the problem that I could present to the point where I felt the students were comfortable enough that they could begin to relate, and then we could throw it open. But I wouldn't say, we'll do this and we're going to rap about it, and then you often have one student who does all the talking and another one who doesn't say anything but who really has a lot to say. I find to avoid this kind of situation, it is better to present a graduate seminar in a little more formal way than is usually presented to begin with. And this is from past experience. When I have done graduate seminars, I've done fill-ins for several people down at Rutgers. That's the way I've approached it. And I did this with Levi Strauss and to some extent with Mark Stahl. They really enjoyed it. And they felt it was more interesting that way than just sort of read and rap kind of thing. And in terms of undergraduate, I believe in well-prepared, coherent lectures. I'm a firm believer that if you want the students to be interested in the subject, you've got to present it in some sort of enthusiastic way and in an orderly format that they can relate to. Even if they're not paying attention, they can somehow grasp, what you're trying to convey.
Last question, you've got to be out here in 2 minutes.
Yes, I don't think you could explain what your concept of the conflict of emergence is, because I understand you came out of evolutionary theory and why you disagree with it.
The concept of
emergence.
I've never heard of it.
You've never heard of it?
I've never heard of it. It came out of evolutionary theory?
Well, I recently read an article by a guy called Abraham Edel, and he is talking about the concept of levels in social theory, and it begins with the concept of emergence, which has the general intent of the thing had been sharpened in evolutionary theory, and then he goes on to elucidate the concept and talk about it in relation to specific epistemology.
That may be a kind of mind-blowing Spencer Parsons and onward. I've not encountered it in my research.
Well, then, okay. Well, what he said was basically the concept had three strands to it. The first strand is one of qualitative novelty. In other words, something new appeared in the history of the world. Secondly, there was the concept of continuity. What had emerged was definitely linked with what had been there before.
I see.
What was there before acted in some kind of way. He unfortunately used the word causal, which I would tend to be a little squeamish about. But he does indicate that what was there before is linked with what is new. What is new does not appear off the thin air like the act of God. The third strand is one of discontinuity. Though it is continuous in some sense with what was there before, nevertheless, it is discontinuous with what was there before. New doesn't, he's careful to point out that when he's talking about it, new is not necessarily, so far that's what he says. And then he raises, in connection with that concept, he raises the problem of whether, once you agree that something new has occurred and so on, whether it may operate in terms of law specific to that level, and whether it will therefore require specific methodologies for that level.
That's,
and then you go on to discuss it
emergence?
As a problem. The concept of emergence.
It's been dealt with extensively, not under the label emergence, but by cultural anthropologists who dealt with cultural evolution. A particular work by Solomons and Service called Evolution and Culture. The work of Service, Solomons, Leslie White, Julian Stewart in Anthropology all discussed those very things.
I think
I imagine this guy came out of a more sociological kind of background. But these have been dealt with by the anthropological tradition known as cultural evolutionism.
I'm not familiar with that. Could you briefly tell me why you disagree with the concept?
No, I don't disagree.
You have to, because you said you said
I don't know, know what it is.
No, excuse me. I'm under the impression that you would have to disagree with it because you said that there was a continuum between nature and culture, and
sure,
you declined the space of specific boundary, which it seemed to me would logically require you to Freddie shaking his head.
The boundary is now in the hall.